Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. This is the second show in our four-part series, A Month of Milosz, which honors Nobel Prize laureate Czesław Miłosz, who has just published his most recent book, Roadside Dog, at the age of 87. He is one of the two or three greatest living poets. Today's show will discuss his tragic experiences during the rise of Nazism and the occupation of Warsaw during World War II. This spring, Claremont McKenna College hosted a festival celebrating Czesław Miłosz's life and work. There, I talked with American poet Robert Haas, who is the poet, most recently, of Sun Under Wood, published by Echo Press. Haas told me about Miłosz's young adult life after his magical childhood in Lithuania.
In his 20s, he went to the University of Vilno, which is the Polish name for what is now the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius. It was, though Miłosz didn't know it at the time, also one of the great centers of the revival of Yiddish culture. Years after that, at an international poetry festival in San Francisco, 1980s, I had the good luck to be present when Miłosz met Singer for the first time. Two Nobel Prize winners from the same part of the world, both in different ways, emigrated to America, speakers of the same language, walkers of the same streets, who had never met, and suddenly fell into passionate conversation. These two old men. It was a wonderful moment. Back to Vilno in the early 1930s, when he began writing his poetry. He went to the university in those years. In the summer after his junior year, he tells this story in one of the books he wrote in the 1950s, one of the great intellectual autobiographies of the 20th century, a book called Native Realm, about taking a canoe trip with two college friends from Vilno to Paris by waterway. So he went right through Prague and Hungary and Germany in the years of the rise of fascism and into Paris. He had a cousin who was Lithuanian, who was a very distinguished, it was another branch of the family, rather aristocratic figure, and a famous French poet who was Lithuanian by birth and happened to be the Lithuanian representative of the League of Nations, so was a figure. So when he got to Paris, this scruffy college kid from the wild provinces, he had an entree to French literary society. So he got to see that world while he was living in a district of Paris for uncarded Polish workers.
This is Michael Silverblatt on Bookworm. And this is 1980 Nobel laureate Czesław Miłosz reading Bypassing Rue Descartes at a Lannan Foundation reading in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
And now, a poem which refers to my stay in the then capital of the world, Paris. As a young poet, I considered that it was proper to be acquainted with Paris, and everybody did that at that time. By passing Rue Descartes, I descended toward the Seine, shy, a traveler, a young barbarian, just come to the capital of the world, where many from Jassy and Koloshvar, Vilno and Bucharest, Saigon and Marrakesh, ashamed to remember the customs of our homes, about which nobody here should ever be told. The clapping of servants, barefooted girls hurry in, dividing food with incantations, choral prayers recited by master and household together. I had left the cloudy provinces behind. I entered the universal, dazzled and desiring. Soon enough, many from Yassi and Koloshvar or Saigon and Marrakesh would be killed because they wanted to abolish the customs of their homes. Soon enough, their peers were seizing power in order to kill in the name of the universal, beautiful ideas. Meanwhile, the city behaved in accordance with its nature, rustling with throaty laughter in the dark, baking long breads and pouring wine into clay pitchers, buying fish, lemons, and garlic at street markets, indifferent as it was to honor and shame and greatness and glory, because that had been done already and had transformed itself into monuments representing nobody knows whom, into arias hardly audible, and into turns of speech. Again, I lean on the rough granite of the embankment, as if I had returned from travels through the underworlds, and suddenly saw in the light the reeling wheel of the seasons, where empires have fallen, and those once living are now dead. There is no capital of the world, neither here nor anywhere else, and the abolished customs are restored to their small fame. And now I know that the time of human generation is not like the time of the earth. As to my heavy sins, I remember one most vividly, how one day, walking on a forest path along a stream, I passed a rock down onto a water snake coiled in the grass. And what I have met with in life was the just punishment which reaches sooner or later the breaker of a taboo. I was brought up in Lithuania, which was the last country to be baptized, and old beliefs survived there. And the water snake was a holy creature. To harm water snake was a great breaking a taboo.
That was Szeszwa Miłosz reading his autobiographical poem, Bypassing Rue Descartes. This is Michael Silverblatt. I asked American poet Ed Hirsch, most recently the author of On Love, published by Knopf, to select a Miłosz poem to read. This is Ed Hirsch reading Encounter by Szeszwa Miłosz.
Encounter. We were riding through frozen fields in a wagon at dawn. A red wing rose in the darkness, and suddenly a hare ran across the road. One of us pointed to it with his hand. That was long ago. Today neither of them is alive, not the hare nor the man who made the gesture. Oh, my love, where are they? Where are they going? The flash of a hand, streak of movement, rustle of pebbles. I ask not out of sorrow, but in wonder. It's a wonderful poem.
That's a great poem.
It's a wonderful poem. He wrote it in Vilno in 1936.
Tell me, before the wars, what was the response to his poetry? Is this what was called the catastrophist poems?
Yeah, he was an up-and-coming young poet, and he was, I think, well-known in a certain avant-garde way as part of this group of catastrophists or catastrophics. And they were a group of poets, and he was one of them, although he's really the only one outside of Poland who's now really known, I think. They were a group of young poets who felt the 20th century changed the world forever. And it comes out of the word catastrophe, and that the catastrophes of the 20th century and the revolutions that had already taken place had changed the world in some kind of metaphysical as well as historical way, that things were really coming to an end. So it was already apocalyptic early in the 1930s in Poland.
But the kind of implicit tenderness in this poem and of things vanishing even as they're happening, and then again in memory, make it hard to identify this with avant-garde poetry.
Well, that was a streak in Miwash's work, but I personally think the deeper thing in his work is the thing you've identified, a tremendous tenderness toward the human. And on the one hand, you have, he thinks about, I think there's been a streak of this catastrophic dimension of his work ever since. There's a lot of thinking in his poetry about the rise and fall of civilizations, the movements of history, what's happened in the 20th century. And you might call that aspect of his work a poetry of witnessing. But then some other element of witnessing, which I think is actually deeper in some profound way, is a deep tenderness towards what is mutable and what is passing. The extraordinary line at the end of that poem, "I asked not in sorrow, but in wonder," fills you with wonder that things pass away, that the hair is gone, the wagon is gone, the person is gone, that the world passes. And this element of his poetry is maybe not the most famous, and it didn't make him the most famous, but I think it's the most profound. And so on the one hand, you have him thinking about large historical movements, even as a young poet. But behind it, there's this deeply humane impulse, a really deep tenderness.
That was Ed Hirsch talking about the work of Czesław Miłosz, the 1980 Nobel laureate and the subject of Bookworm's A Month of Miłosz series. This is the second program in the series, American poet Robert Haas.
He snuck into Warsaw, which meant that he spent the next six years, right at the center of the horror of the Nazi occupation of Eastern Europe and the extermination of the European Jews, which is a story that people know. Part of the story that people don't always know is that an enormous number of Poles were also exterminated. I should say about Miłosz in those years that he wrote poetry in the underground while he worked as a teamster, hauling books back and forth from one library to another, which was the kind of job most of the Polish writers had. They refused to work in any way in the cultural apparatus serving Nazi propaganda, so they did that kind of work. When it looked like the Russian army was about to invade Warsaw, people in the underground who were in contact with the Polish government in exile in London arranged a pre-established time when the Poles in the underground would come out onto the streets and fight the Nazis as the Russians were advancing across the river into the city, so that there would be a Polish government of sorts in place when the Russians arrived. This was supposedly coordinated with the Russian army. The signal was given. Young Poles with bottles full of gasoline, handmade guns, stolen guns, went into the streets, and the Russian army waited on the other side of the river while the German army killed 250,000 Poles. It took 3 or 4 days. The signal was given for the German army to retreat, and as a final act of retribution, they demolition squads destroyed the central city of Warsaw, the old city, building by building and block by block.
This is Robert Haas reading Czesław Miłosz's poem Dedication, written for the dead of the Warsaw Uprising.
Dedication. You whom I could not save, listen to me. Try to understand this simple speech as I would be ashamed of another. I swear There is in me no wizardry of words. I speak to you with silence, like a tree or a cloud. What strengthened me for you was lethal. You mixed up farewell to an epoch with the beginning of a new one. Inspiration of hatred with lyrical beauty. Blind force with accomplished shape. Here is a valley of shallow Polish rivers and an immense bridge going into white fog. Here is a broken city, and the wind throws the screams of gulls on your grave when I am talking with you. What is poetry which does not save nations or people? A connivance with official lies. A song of drunkards whose throats will be cut in a moment, reading for sophomore girls. That I wanted good poetry without knowing it, that I discovered late its salutary aim, in this, and only this, I find salvation. They used to pour millet on graves, or poppy seeds, to feed the dead who would come disguised as birds. I put this book here for you, who once lived, so that you should visit us no more. Warsaw, 1945.
Robert Haas, reading dedication by Czesław Miłosz. Thank you very much, Bob. Among the guests at the celebration of the works of Czesław Miłosz is Helen Wendler, who has come from Harvard. She is, as is well known, really the most influential critic about contemporary poetry. But more than that, one knows why. She is passionate and interesting. Now, when I began to read Miłosz, I was surprised by in the poems that were in the later years, the jump immediately to wisdom, almost as if they bypass initial situation or even detail, but end in transcendence without any preparation. It seems very different from an American tradition of poetry. Is that difference real? Is it part of Miłosz's own gift, his eccentricity, a tradition he works from? I'm always surprised to see how quickly he arrives at the general.
Well, his own poetry is a continual jump from, you might say, the most particular but usually abstracted, a man, a carriage, a hare running across the fields, but the man is not named. One knows it happened in Miłosz's childhood in Poland, but the place is not named. Simply a scene that is engraved on his mind that won't go away, even though he's 70 years away from it. So that the very particular scene of man, carriage, hare couldn't be more particular in one sense, and yet it's a scene that could have taken place almost anywhere in Europe in the early years of this century. Then the leap to the general. We heard him cite Heraclitus this morning. The fragments of the pre-Socratics especially are always in his mind because they present wisdom in a compressed gnomic form. In that sense, he probably comes closest not to the Emerson of the poetry, who was more discursive, but the Emerson of the journals, with fragmented wisdom sentences scattered through observations on the events of the day or something of that kind. But I would say that Miłosz's fundamental aspect as a poet is the ability to reduce, you might say, the universals to an extremely particular and sharply etched visual scene, which is nonetheless kept sufficiently general so that it could be felt in one's own life or elsewhere. The trouble for Miwosh is that the law of aesthetic form means that no matter what you write about, torture, war, suffering, death, it comes out beautiful, quote-unquote, that is to say, orderly, harmonious, and directed towards some kind of convergence with itself at the end to make an aesthetic form. And the poem in which he expressed this most savagely, this contradiction between aesthetic beauty and the content of tragic literature, is the poem I'd like to read, called The Poor Poet, written in and dated Warsaw, 1944, when Warsaw was being bombed by both the Nazis and the Germans, and manhunts in the streets made you see people cut down every day. And it's about that very contradiction between the beauty of the flowering rod, Aaron's rod from the Bible, and the terrible subject matter of poetry. The Poor Poet. The first movement is singing, a free voice filling mountains and valleys. The first movement is joy, but it is taken away. And now that the years have transformed my blood, and thousands of planetary systems have been born and died in my flesh, I sit a sly and angry poet with malevolently squinted eyes, and weighing a pen in my hand, I plot revenge. I poise the pen, and it puts forth twigs and leaves. It is covered with blossoms, and the scent of that tree is impudent, for there, on the real earth, such trees do not grow, and like an insult to suffering humanity is the scent of that tree. Some take refuge in despair, which is sweet, like strong tobacco, like a glass of vodka drunk in the hour of annihilation. Others have the hope of fools, rosy as erotic dreams. Still others find peace in the idolatry of country, which can last for a long time, although little longer than the 19th century lasts. But to me a cynical hope is given, for since I opened my eyes, I have seen only the glow of fires, massacres, only injustice, humiliation, and the laughable shame of braggarts. To me is given the hope of revenge on others and on myself, for I was he who knew and took from it no profit for myself.
Helen Fendler reading The Poor Poet by Czesław Miłosz.
Helen Fendler teaches at Harvard. Her most recent book is The Art of Shakespeare's Sonnets, published by Harvard University Press. This is Michael Silverblatt talking now with Czesław Miłosz.
You speak in the Book of Luminous Things of a willingness, because of the poems in that book, that international anthology, to describe the charms of the physical world, to consider it a book of enchantments. And yet enchantment would seem to be not a positive thing.
Not a positive?
Yes.
Or positive?
Not positive.
Why?
It seems to me that to be enchanted, on the one hand, one runs the risk of being fooled.
Oh, really? I conceive that word differently, because I see it equivalent in my language, in Polish. Marveling is better.
Ah, a book of marvels. Yes.
Yeah.
Because I think of you as a poet as having, in many cases, resisted dangerous enchantments.
No. A basic duality is in my life, in my poetry, namely realization that life is horrible, the world is horrible, feeling of horror at the sight what is going on in the world. On the other hand, marveling, I mean, because it's so beautiful, and that's a contradiction which we cannot overcome. I doubt whether anybody can overcome.
And yet it has been your life's work. It has been your life's work.
Yeah, it's trying to to overcome that contradiction, but with full awareness that contradictions feed us and nourish us and are unavoidable.
This is Czeszła Miłosz reading on angels at the Lannan Foundation reading in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Not everything is lost because there are angels, and I am going to read a poem on angels. All was taken away from you, white dresses, wings, even existence. Yet I believe you, messengers. There, where the world is turned inside out, a heavy fabric embroidered with stars and beasts, you stroll, inspecting the trustworthy themes. Short is your stay here, now and then at a matinal hour, if the sky is clear, in a melody repeated by a bird, or in the smell of apples at the close of day, when the light makes the orchards magic. They say somebody had invented you, but to me this doesn't sound convincing, for humans invented themselves as well. The voice, no doubt it is a valid proof, as it can belong only to radiant creatures, weightless and winged after all, why not? Girdled with the lightning. I have heard that voice many a time when asleep. And what is strange, I understood more or less an order or an appeal in an unearthly tongue. Day draws near. Another one, do what you can.
Czeszła Miłosz reading on angels. I'd like to repeat the end of the poem. I have heard that voice many a time when asleep, and, what is strange, I understood more or less an order or an appeal in an unearthly tongue. Day grows near, another one. Do what you can. This is Michael Silverblatt. Join me next week on Bookworm for the third show in our four-part A Month of Miłosz, honoring the Nobel laureate. We are grateful to the Echo Press and Farrah, Straus & Giroux, who publish Miłosz's poetry in America. Gratitude, too, to Robert Fagan and the staff of the Claremont McKenna College Athenaeum. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Development by Beverly Walker. Alan Howard is co-producer on A Month of Miłosz. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.